Welcome to this afternoon's program of At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network. It is the 6th of July, blazing hot here in New York City. And before we begin today's program, I'd like to thank our sponsor, TechServe. Heritage Radio Network is supported by TechServe. TechServe's having an e-waste recycling event created to help keep hazardous materials out of landfills by recycling electronics. Saturday, July 10th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. is when the event will be held at 23rd Street near 6th Avenue. Info at techserve.com/recycling. And we'll begin today's program with the Week in Wine recap and latest news. Over the weekend, Jacques Boissonneau, wine consultant to four of the five first gross in Bordeaux, was named winemaker of the decade at a ceremony held at Chateau Raison Seigle in Margaux, reports Decanter. The award was given by Xing Po Tiong of the Chinese Bordeaux Guide to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the publication. Boissonneau, who today works alongside his son Eric, has been a consultant in the Medoc for over 40 years and trained under Emile Pinault, working with roughly 180 properties, including Latour, Lafitte, Rothschild, and Gros La Rose, just to name a few. Also reported by Decanter.com, Smith Haute Lafitte will begin exporting wines by sail-powered ship. The 106-year-old British ship Bessie Allen will set sail from Bordeaux for Montreal on July 21st, carrying 20,000 bottles of Smith Haute Lafitte. The ship will also carry bottles from Chateau de Caix, the Cahors domain owned by the Danish royal family. The move was introduced in an effort to cut the chateau's carbon footprint. The 25-day sail-powered crossing will cost around 20% more the same journey in a standard container ship. The shippers based in Dublin claim the journey will most likely improve the wine, some of them giving the impression of having aged a year in the process of the route. A regular sail route between Montreal and Bordeaux and Bordeaux and Plymouth is pegged to begin next March 2011. And in the market feed, the Napa Valley Register has reported that wineries in Napa Valley sell more cases of wine directly to consumers than any other grape-growing region in the U.S. In the 12 months ending in March, the country shipped 760,000 cases valued at $481 million. The next closest region was Sonoma County, with 581,000 cases worth $258 million. The average price of a Napa bottle shipped directly to consumers was $52.69, followed by Sonoma at $36.99 per bottle. Cabernet Sauvignon was the most popular Napa varietal at 415,846 cases, followed by Pinot Noir. This report, prepared by Wines and Vines, comes at a time when major wholesale distributors are supporting House Resolution 5034 federal legislation that would stop direct shipping to consumers. Direct shipping allows the smaller wineries to keep more of the profits and build friendships with their customers. Many wineries depend on direct-to-consumer shipping, and winemakers attest that if the bill were to pass, it would be devastating to their business. We're going to take a short break, but before, I'd like to just say we'll be back with my guest this afternoon, Justin Christoph, who's been a guest in the past. He has a website called RieslingAC.com and is a Riesling fanatic. And today we're going to talk about the Finger Lakes in New York. So we'll be right back after the break. You are listening to At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network, www.heritageradionetwork.com, which airs today, 4 p.m., and every Tuesday. And I'm here today with Justin Christoph. Welcome, Justin.
Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming. Justin had just returned from a visit up to the Finger Lakes region, and we wanted to devote today's program to speaking a bit about this wine region, which often gets overlooked.
Absolutely. I think we were just mentioning wine exports from Napa and Bordeaux and the Finger Lakes definitely get overlooked in the equation. There's a little bit of attention here because we are in New York, but I think in the wider world, definitely deserves more attention.
What were some of the impressions that you had? I know you had said you'd been there in 2003, which was 7 years ago, and it takes a while for a wine region that's investing in their own infrastructure to make those changes. But did you notice anything different in your recent visit?
Oh, definitely. The quality was definitely improved, and there were more wineries and doing more interesting things, and more reserve bottlings, more attention to detail, more vinifera that we're familiar with, like Merlot and Riesling and Chardonnay, and less weird hybrid grapes and Native American grapes like Concord that are best for jellies and eating.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's back up a bit and talk about the development of the region itself, because you mentioned hybrids and then vinifera, which are European grape varietals, and it's an interesting perspective to look back at how the region really gained its footing.
Absolutely. It started more as a table grape growing region and for eating off the and jams and jellies, and eventually became more known for making jug wines, unfortunately, which I think still contributes to its bad reputation. But Dr. Frank, Herman Weimer, and Bill Wagner, who just passed away 2 weeks ago, all were pioneers in starting the drive towards vinifera and quality wines and getting Finger Lake wines recognized, and realizing that the climate is cold up there, but the Finger Lakes are so deep, they're glacier lakes, so the depth varies from 200 to 400 feet, and they basically store heat during the winter and allow the, if you plant the vines close enough to the lake, they allow the vines to make it through the cold winters up there, where you're basically up by Ithaca and Rochester. Mm-hmm. So it is quite cold, but if you're close to the lake, the vinifera can survive and thrive.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Constantine Frank, and who is a Russian immigrant, and he had foresaw that the region would be a good place to grow European grape varietals, even though many people kind of ridiculed him because it was such a cold climate, they thought that they wouldn't survive.
Absolutely. It was his doctoral thesis, and to prove them wrong, he went out and proceeded to start his own nursery and his own winery, and he produces much of the rootstock and vines for the other wineries in the Finger Lakes and other regions as well, and makes some fantastic Riesling and Gewürztraminers and other vines as well, mm-hmm. under his own label, and also the Salmon Run label, which is his second label.
And then when we talk about vinifera and Lambrusca, let's define for our listeners what that really translates to.
Basically, there are three types of wines. They're the Native American wines that you would like a Concord or a Cayuga, and those are usually best as eating grapes. You can make wine from them, but they don't really usually have, they're more sweet. They have less alcohol. They have kind of like a foxy, varnishy kind of taste. Mm-hmm. They're a little bit weird. And then there are the classic European varietals that we're more familiar with, Riesling, Chardonnay, Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, that make great wines, and they're smaller berries, and their flavor profile and genetics lends them to making wines. And then between them you have hybrids or crosses that people came up with, like Sauvignon Blanc and Vidal Blanc, where they took a Native American grape and a European grape to create something else to try to have the hardiness of Native American grapes, which are resistant to cold, and also phylloxera, mm-hmm. which European grape varietals are not resistant to phylloxera. But ultimately, the best solution came using Native American rootstock and then grafting the European varietals on the Native American rootstock, so you get the best of both worlds. You get the top and the berries and the fruit of the European varietals, and you get the bottom of the Native Americans that are resistant to phylloxera, because phylloxera originated in North America. Mm-hmm. So the Native American grape varietals are used to it because it's like a common cold to them, whereas sure. it was devastating to the European varietals.
Mm-hmm. So Constantine Frank was really the pioneer that kind of said, well, we're going to use this vinifera, the European grape varietals, and plant it here, Pinot Noir, Riesling, Chardonnay, and the Vida Blanc and things that also are planted and widespread in Canada, over time became less associated with the region.
They're still popular and prevalent up there. They're mostly using them for like ice vines and some late harvest wines, mm-hmm. and some of the smaller wineries that are like mom and pop like them a lot. But I think the serious wines now are basically for the Finger Lakes are Riesling, Chardonnay, Cabernet Franc, and Pinot Noir, and maybe Gewurztraminer. You'd throw in that mix as well. It had some very good Gewurztraminers up there, but those are probably the five most important grapes up there as far as quality would go.
Let's talk a little bit about the climate, too. I mean, how it's been compared to Germany in terms of its association with the lakes and the water, kind of protecting the environment, and then also with the cold nights, which prolong the growing season. So it's a short growing season, but it really keeps that acidity in the grapes.
The cool nights help keep the acidity in the grapes. That's a good point. And it is similar to Germany as far as it is a cold climate. In Germany, you have the rivers being the moderating influence, the Mosel and the Rhine. Up there, you have the lakes up there doing the same effect. You have similar slate soils. They are a little bit different, so they will taste different because, especially for Riesling, which is the queen of grapes, it's very transparent, so it is very reflective of the soil where it's grown, but there are some similar soil types that that some of the quality conscious New York Finger Lakes producers are exploiting and making some very credible outstanding examples of Riesling.
Mm-hmm. And where do you think, I mean, in terms of the lakes themselves, you know, Cayuga, Seneca, Keuka, is there one that is kind of the primo wine?
I think there's a lot of focus on Seneca right now because that's where the most wineries are,
mm-hmm.
and it's the largest and the deepest, and it's kind of in the middle of it all. Cayuga is where Dr. Frank and Heron Hill are, and a lot of the old school guys, even though it doesn't have a lot of wineries, it has a lot of the older ones.
Mm-hmm.
A number of the wineries do get their grapes from different lakes, even though they happen to be on one lake, so they might get different vineyards and from different lakes. Cayuga is very interesting. That's the far eastern one. There are less wineries there, but that may have the most potential and some of the most interesting soil types. But they're starting new wineries there, and they are starting new vineyards, but it just takes time. You just don't start a vineyard and then like next year you have wine. It's like a 10-15 year process.
Absolutely,
so it's fun seeing some of the developments there, but the true potential is going to be probably realized at the end or even past our lifetimes,
mm-hmm.
of people listening on this show. That's just the slow nature of winemaking, that the timelessness of it, which is part of the attraction to
Absolutely,
it as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The art of that. Patience. and I know it's been called the Finger Lakes an emerging wine region, and when people think of emerging wine regions, they think of new regions, however it may be. Most of the regions that are called emerging are pretty deep in history. Some of the emerging regions that we see in other parts of the world, particularly in South America, are having foreign investment. Do you find that up in the Finger Lakes it's more Americans who are driving the business and there's not necessarily a foreign investment into the region?
There are some bigger companies coming in, but it's a little bit refreshing. It's more families starting it. There are a couple people that were disaffected Manhattanites as well that made a little bit of money doing various things in New York and started got tired of the rat race and moved up there and started doing some things. But like we mentioned, Bill Wagner passed away. The winery's been around for a long time, and his grandchildren and grandchildren are working on it and expanding it. Dr. Frank is now a third generation, and his granddaughter would be would skip another generation, be the fifth generation. So there's the economies of scale are a lot less expensive up there. The real estate's much less expensive than Long Island. As far as other New York State wines, and way, way, way less expensive than Napa or Sonoma. So it's a little more conducive to a small business entrepreneur or family farmer business. A lot of them started out as farmers and grew grapes for jellies and jams and eating, and then other crops like peaches and cows and whatnot, and then kind of started to focus more on wine because that's there's a little more money in that, and it's a little more interesting than the average crop.
Yeah. And it's also noteworthy to point out that it is the largest growing region in New York. I mean, we're given our proximity to Long Island. That's what we often think of first and foremost, and we have more access to those wines. But it is, there are about 11,000 acres under vine right now.
Yeah, it's huge. It's stretched over three lakes. You could easily spend a couple hours driving around there. It's about 4 to 5 hours to drive up there. But once you're up there, it's a really worthwhile place to visit. The people are very friendly. There's some very good B&Bs that are reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not as much traffic out there. It's kind of nice, too, that there aren't a lot of Manhattanites there. So when you go on vacation, you're actually away from the people you're trying to get away from, as opposed to going someplace where everybody else is going.
Transplanted. To,
yeah, exactly. Just like, oh, how did you get here? It's right. Like, oh, fancy meeting you here.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a little less of that. There is a fair amount of tourism there, but it's more people from like Rochester, Albany, Northern Pennsylvania, and that local area there that are up there enjoying themselves. And there are also other culinary delights there. There's a lot of great dairies, and the cheese industry is starting to grow up there, and they have a couple cheese trail events in addition to the wine trail, the microbreweries and distilleries, and some very good seasonal crops. And cool. I was up there, is asparagus and fiddlehead ferns, and
mm-hmm.
just a lot of great things going on up there. And the cost is fairly reasonable too, because you have less people from Manhattan, which, you know, basically ruins the price on anything unless
sure.
you get we becomes a victim of its own success.
As for the slopes, the way that the trellises are planted and whatnot on the hillsides, are they pretty steep, or is it?
It's not as steep as Germany. There's a fair amount of mechanization up in the Finger Lakes, mm-hmm. and they are close to the lakes, but they tried to stay away from the steeper hillsides. And I think that may be actually an area for improvement, because they grew on the more easily cultivatable areas first, but the most easily cultivatable areas aren't necessarily the best areas, especially for finicky varietals like Pinot Noir. And Riesling might do better on the steeper slopes. So
right.
I
have some better sun exposure as well.
I saw some forests there that were some very steep hillsides that somebody that's very brave might make some very interesting vineyards.
Get on it. Get there.
If there's any investors listening to the show.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Well, we're going to take a short break and be right back. Again, this is Justin Christoph, and we're talking about Finger Lakes, New York. Welcome back to this afternoon's program of At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick talking about the Finger Lakes region with Justin Christoph, who has a website, RieslingAC.com. And we are also reporting on the current game, the World Cup game that is going on right now, the Netherlands 3, to one, Uruguay. And this leads me into another topic that Justin was telling me a bit about before the break. He recently held a Riesling World Cup in tandem with this year's tournament. So please tell us a bit about that.
Thanks. The concept basically was to do a blind tasting of 12 different Rieslings from different countries. Not necessarily the same as the World Cup nations, because we had to focus on areas that produce great Rieslings. So
the Netherlands wasn't in that one.
the Netherlands and Ghana somehow didn't make the Riesling World Cup, despite their great soccer team. So, but we did have Germany, Austria, France, South Africa was represented, Chile, the Bio Valley. We found a Riesling from Israel. We had Washington State, Oregon, New York State, which we're talking about today, Australia, New Zealand. And so we were all over the place, and we were trying to keep them around $20 price point, blind tasting. I've had about 20 people there, consumers and trade people. And Germany won, of course, but there's a very strong showing by New York State, the Hermann Weimer semi-dry 2008. I finished third place, and
excellent.
The difference between first and third place is very close. It was basically the top three wines got all the votes, and then it was kind of everybody else. So
everyone brought a bottle, or did you organize all the wines?
I organized all the wines, so I didn't vote because I knew what they were, but I had 12 of them in brown paper bag, numbered 1 through 12, and two bottles of each wine because we had about 25 people all together, and everybody voted for their third favorite, second favorite, first favorite. So if it was your first favorite, it got 3 points, and if it was your third favorite, it got 1 point. And then I tallied up all the points, and Donhoff 09 State Riesling won. And since he's the king of Germany, the king of Nahe, the king of Germany, he won. But it was very close. New Zealand was a second place,
okay,
with Pegasus Bay, and that was kind of a dark horse, no pun intended. And nobody really expected that. You would think France or Austria would be in there, but they didn't show that well. And then New York State with Hermann Weimer, 08 semi-dry Riesling, was right behind those other two wines. And
very cool.
A lot of people's favorite wine. And it was a great showing. 08 was a great year for Riesling in the Finger Lakes. And 09 looks to be even better. So right now you're going to see a lot of 08s on store shelves, and the 09s will start trickling in, depending on the producer. Generally, as they sell out of the 08s, they bring out the 09s, which is good, because I think 07 was a little bit difficult. 07 is quite a hot year, and 08 and 09 were cooler years. The Riesling generally prefers the cooler years up there. And 07 was better for the Cab Franc and the Pinot Noir. The reds finally got ripe enough up there, but not so good for Riesling. But that's the great thing about different vintages, is different grapes do better from year to year.
And well, that doesn't sound too dissimilar from Germany's vintage. I mean, the 07 was a little bit warmer, a little bit riper grape style. And 08, it was just so, driven by acidity, a colder year.
Yeah, pure, precise wines.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And 09 might have the best of all worlds. I managed to get a few samples of some 09s just being in the trade, even though they weren't for release. And I think the 09s were some of the best wines I've ever tasted up there.
Oh, yeah?
I think partly it was the vintage, and I think partly it's the maturity of the winemakers and the maturity of the vines and the maturity of the industry.
So this is from the Finger Lakes, you're saying?
Yeah,
you got the samples
Lakes,
from?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, from the Finger Lakes. It's a great year in Germany, too, but it seems like every year in the past 5 years is a great year in Germany.
Right.
So they've been on a roll there. But for the Finger Lakes, I think it's 09 will be a coming-of-age vintage. And
well, hopefully they won't command the same prices. I imagine, I know they won't, but the Bordeaux prices of 09 have just...
I think
shot out the roof, so we can look for some better values from the Finger Lakes.
For the case of a price of 09 Lafitte, you could buy a pretty nice vineyard in the Finger Lakes and retire. It is a little ridiculous. It's just fermented grape juice at the end of the day, so I think you have to kind of keep it in perspective. And I think that's the great thing about the Finger Lakes in general. There's a lot of great wines from $15 to $25, and that's a price point that a lot of people can relate to and get into wine, and it's not all hocus pocus and mystery is why does this bottle cost $1,000, but... so I think that's part of the accessibility of the area and the wines, and that they're but I think they are improving, and you are seeing some more expensive wines. Some of the Hermann Weimer single vineyard wines are approaching $40 plus, but my opinion, they're worth it, and I think you could stick those wines in a blind tasting with some German and Austrian wines, and people might recognize them being different, but I think people wouldn't bat an eye towards the quality being any less.
Now, what about age? I mean, when we think of Riesling, we just think about it, such a versatile grape variety, and the capacity to age is just remarkable. How have you seen the wines from the Finger Lakes age? I mean, given that, you know, the grapes were planted later in history.
Yeah, I think they have good aging potential and more aging potential than people realize. But because the vines are younger and they are picking a little bit earlier and they are making wines in a little bit more softer consumer style, they probably don't age as well as the top German wines. By the same token, I think a lot of Finger Lakes Rieslings will age a lot better than a California Chardonnay will at the same price point.
Right.
I did two vertical tastings when I was up at the Finger Lakes. One was at Lucas Vineyard. We tasted back to 01.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, 01 doesn't sound that old, but it's 9 years old already.
Yeah,
and it was still very youthful. And I think the 01 and the 02 could both go another 4, 5, 6 years easily before showing any age. And for Dr. Frank, we did a vertical tasting back to 95. And the 97 was showing a bit of age, but the 95 was still brilliant at age 15, and you know, I think had a couple more years left in it. And there's a old tavern in Hammondsport that has all sorts of back vintages of Cabernet Franc, Gewurztraminer, and Riesling.
I was going to ask you, how might we get our hands on some of those?
I forget what it's called, but there's like two roads and two horses in Hammondsport, so it's not that difficult to find.
Right, right.
But, you know, and you go up there and you try some of the bottles, and, you know, you get some bad bottles and you get some bottles that are mediocre, but most of the wines on the wine list are under $50 a bottle, so it's fun to go there and explore. And then when you find one that's really good, it's just an amazing discovery you won't find anywhere else. But I think those examples show there is the potential for the Finger Lakes wines to age in general, in particular the Rieslings, when they come from a good vintage.
Very cool. Well, what's in store for you this summer? Any other tastings that you're putting together?
I think we're going to do a couple more Riesling AC tastings. We're kind of soliciting some interest, maybe doing another blind tasting, but maybe a little more focus. Maybe we'll focus on the Finger Lakes, depending on the feedback from the show.
And, definitely.
I think there's the sky's the limit there.
Well, I look forward to going up there. It's been quite some time since I've been there, so thanks for your suggestions.
Absolutely. For anybody that wants to go up there, there's the Finger Lakes Wine Festival in Watkins Glen, and that's July 16th to 18th, and I think the tickets vary from $25 to $40, so it's cheaper than renting the car.
Right. It's a good excuse.
And I think out of the 100 Finger Lakes wineries, 60 of them are there, so you could probably taste as much Riesling or anything else you want for that matter. So
what's the date on that again?
It's July 16th to 18th in Watkins Glen, and the best websites to check out Finger Lake wines are fingerlakeswinecountry.com and fingerlakeswine.com, and they both have events pages, and then each lake has its own trail. So Seneca Lake has its own wine trail, Cayuga and Cayuga. So then you can click on there, and then you can click on each individual winery and find out what their tasting hours and schedule and events are like. So those are good resources to utilize.
Love it. Well, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to doing a tasting sometime on air together.
Look forward to it.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening today, and to our sponsor, TechServe. One other event to mention is the event that TechServe is hosting on Saturday, July 10th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 23rd Street near 6th Avenue. It's TechServe's e-waste recycling event. And also a thank you to our engineer today, Nat Wiener, and producer, Jack Inslee. See you again soon.
Pensando que eras mía, pero aquel antifaz que por fortuna no fuera un antifaz de terciopelo, al descorrer de tu existencia el velo, me mostró tus infamias una.